Welcome everyone to this IFG event with the Lord Speaker, Lord McFall. My name's Hannah White, I'm Director of the IFG and delighted to welcome everyone who's made it here through the rain to the IFG and all those who are joining us online. We're delighted that Lord McFall is going to give a keynote speech here tonight. Then I'll have the opportunity to put some questions to him, and then we will open up to the room to ask questions and also take questions from online. So if you are watching online, please use the Slido function, and I will select questions from there. If you would like to let us know who you are and where you're speaking from, then that is always nice context. The House of Lords is always a topical topic, perhaps never more so than at the moment with everyone's attention on the Rwanda bill. But I think it's fair to say that the role, the purpose, the future of the House of Lords is a fairly perennial topic in Whitehall and Westminster. So that's why we're particularly delighted that Lord McFall has decided to join us this evening to give his speech. Of course, he became Lord Speaker in 2021, having served as Senior Deputy Speaker for 5 years by that point. He had entered the Lords in 2010 after spending 23 years as an MP in the Commons. He has seen it from both sides, as it were. In the Commons, of course, he served as a Minister in the Northern Ireland Office, as a Government Whip, and chaired the Treasury Select Committee between 2001 and 2010, including during, of course, then the financial crisis. So plenty of experience, and I'm hoping really interesting to hear your reflections tonight. So can I invite you to give us your remarks?
Thank you, Anna. Thank you. Well, thanks very much, Anna. It's a real pleasure for me to be here tonight, particularly as you were a former parliamentary clerk. So normally when I speak at events outside Parliament, I spend a lot of time explaining how the House of Lords works. I emphasise our complementary role to the Commons, revising legislation, advising governments, and assisting democracy. There are a lot of misconceptions and stereotypes about the Lords, and therefore there is still an important job to do, explaining our work to the public, especially to young people. Just a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to over 200 students at the University of Manchester. And in advance, I prepared all the tough questions. What do the Lords actually do? Why aren't you elected? And why are you all so old? I'm glad to report that it was a good dialogue and the questions were positive and incisive. However, for tonight, I think only a brief explanation about the role of our second chamber will be needed. Instead, I want to tell you about what we're doing in the Lords to challenge misconceptions, engage with the public, and prepare the House of Lords for the future. I will also offer some reflections on the continuing debate about Lords reform. Having been around Westminster for almost 40 years, I have a few thoughts to share. But I believe that the Lords adds enormous value to our democracy. But a lack of understanding of our work remains a problem. When I stood to become Lord Speaker, I said we needed a vibrant second chamber which is open, transparent, and engages with the wider public. And public engagement, for me, is one of the most important aspects of my job. That is why I launched the Lord Speaker's Corner podcast in February of last year. Podcasts are a central part of the modern media landscape, and the potential to use them to connect with wider audiences is enormous. In each episode, I interview a member of the House about their life and work in the Lords. The 15 episodes we have published to date have reached an audience of over 1.5 million across all platforms. The podcast demonstrates the diversity of experience and the background of our members. It dispels myths and celebrates the talent and the diversity in our ranks. In a recent episode, Peter Mandelson spoke frankly about his difficulties being outed as a gay man in the 1980s. Norman Lamont told me about his attempt to take politics out of the setting of interest rates, a move which foreshadowed the Bank of England becoming independent from government. And Floella Benjamin spoke candidly about the discrimination she faced in the acting world and spoke passionately about getting proper compensation for the Windrush generation. This podcast is now a vital part of our work to show that vibrant and experienced Second Chamber. And future episodes will include interviews with Baroness Varsey and Baroness Chakrabarty, two notable public figures and members of the House. Another important area is the Learn with the Lords programme. Members contact and connect with schools in person and online, giving young people an opportunity to question peers about the purpose and operations of the House. And last year alone, over 60 members spoke to almost 20,000 students in over 600 schools up and down the country. Learn with the Lords continues to go from strength to strength, and the feedback from young people and teachers is consistently positive. As one teacher recently said, the students relish the opportunity to get a first-hand insight into the workings of the House of Lords. And the session, and I quote, brought the subject to life, helping students to see how the topics that they read about play out in real life. Our outreach programme now extends to the higher education level. We have just launched a brand new Parliament for Researchers programme. Working with the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, I initiated this project to connect researchers and students with peers, PhD students largely. The intention is to promote a two-way dialogue with our members being kept informed of the most cutting-edge research for use in committee reports or the Chamber, and researchers learning more about how they can engage practically with Parliament. Last Friday, Lord Ravensdale, an engineer by background, spoke to over 400 researchers online, and this is the first in a series which we expect to grow and develop over time, and it will cover different areas of research. So these are just some of the ways we reach out to students of all ages. But what about reaching out to other parts of the UK? This is something I feel strongly about, and that's why I made it a point of principle to visit every speaker from the four home nations within my first year in this role. On each visit, I was welcomed by representatives from all parts of the political spectrum, demonstrating the desire from the nations to remain in close dialogue with the UK Parliament. As a result of these meetings and with the agreement of my fellow speakers, we were able to establish the Interparliamentary Forum. Now, this is a group made up of parliamentarians from the four nations who come together on an equal footing to discuss common issues. Just a couple of weeks ago, the forum had another productive meeting in Westminster, and that included members from the reconvened Northern Ireland Assembly. For my part, maintaining these strong relationships with our counterparts across the UK is crucial. We must also continue to foster a healthy dialogue with our friends and neighbours in the Republic of Ireland. And I was privileged to be the first Lord Speaker to be invited to visit the Oireachtas and address their Seanad. As Ambassador for the House of Lords, I've had external engagement with countries near and far, from South Africa to East Timor, all with the aim of deepening the connections between our nations. And with division increasing globally, nurturing these ties is critical. As well as reaching out nationally and globally, we are also promoting innovations within the House. As Lord Speaker, in fact, at the time I was Deputy Speaker, I launched a review of Lords Select Committees, which looked at every aspect from their resources through to the subjects they covered. The committee structured in the Lords developed sporadically over a number of decades, and that resulted in a situation where some areas of public policy were extremely well scrutinised by committees, while others were almost ignored. The review defined the five key principles for Lords committees. The committees should be cross-cutting, they should be comprehensive, they should be flexible, should be outward-looking and effective. And as a result, we put in place a new structure of thematic committees that cover every major area of public policy and complement the departmental focus of our Commons counterparts. Now, our committees have the flexibility and the resources they need to provide first-class scrutiny and reports, and crucially, make use of the full breadth of expertise and experience that resides in our chamber. They have the capacity and freedom to examine the pressing issues of the day, while also looking at long-term, complex challenges for our society. Our Digital Committee, for example, recently urged the UK not to miss out on the potential AI gold rush that could be delivered by large language models like ChatGPT. Last month, the Industry and Regulators Committee published its report, Who Watches the Watchdogs?, raising concerns regarding the independence and accountability of regulators. Our Science and Technology Committee has warned that the government's energy security and net zero commitments are at risk in a report entitled Long Duration Energy Storage. Get on with it. The committee is chaired by Baroness Brown, Principal of the Engineering Faculty at the University of Cambridge and an expert on low carbon technology. Post-legislative scrutiny is also a key element of our committee activity. This work is a particular specialism in our House, pursuing a reflective approach to fill a scrutiny gap often neglected elsewhere. This year, we have appointed two such committees. One is tasked with reviewing the Modern Slavery Act 2015, while the other will look at the Inquiries Act 2005. Let me turn now to recent changes to our procedures. The House has proved to be more adept and responsive to change than is sometimes credited with being. The COVID pandemic forced Parliament to adapt quickly to different ways of working, and we have now embedded some of those changes. For instance, we continue to allow remote participation, including in legislative debates and votes, for some members with disabilities. This marks significant progress in making the House as inclusive as possible. A Parliament, however, is primarily a place where people must be able to meet together in person and which should be open to the public. In that respect, I feel we have quite a bit more work ahead of us to improve physical accessibility within the palace. We need to retain a focus on this for members, staff, and importantly, visitors, as we take forward the restoration and renewal of the palace, the strategic case for which was published last week. Our ability to adapt our proceedings was most recently demonstrated by changes we made following the appointment of Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton as Foreign Secretary. The established procedures for putting questions to a Secretary of State were reviewed to see how they could be used to scrutinise the work of Lord Cameron. Secretary of State questions were moved from a Thursday to a busier Tuesday slot, and we also expanded the time made available for such questions by a third. In addition to his regular question time slot, The Foreign Secretary has also participated in general debates, including a six-hour debate on foreign policy just the other week. The Commons is seldom able to make time for such lengthy general scrutiny of policy. And given the multiple crises which we face globally, the fact that the Lords has experts available to consider these matters, informed by a wide range of professional and political experience, is crucial. The respectful, courteous nature of our debate is also an important attribute. We have also, within the administration of the House, undertaken a programme of cultural and managerial change following an external management review. This long-term work continues to deliver significant improvements to corporate governance, transparency and accountability. These recent changes to our practices and procedures demonstrate that the Lords is alive to the need for change. We are able to address the issues that are in our hands. But we cannot control all of the factors that affect our reputation. For instance, we are not responsible for appointments to the House and cannot control its overall size. The criticism we receive often has its roots in this area. It is important to acknowledge the political context when considering reform. Studies show that trust in our institutions is extremely low, and there is a high degree of frustration with our politics. Within this context, the system of appointments to the House is seen as a weakness. However, it is also a strength. Many experienced people in the House would not have stood for election, perhaps in part because their careers would not have allowed it. One such person is astronomer Royal Lord Rees of Ludlow, who discussed this point with me in the latest episode of the Lord Speaker's Corner podcast, which was out this morning. Many wouldn't have the time or inclination to go door-knocking for a particular political party. And such people typically value their independence as opposed to any political alignment or membership. The combination of different talents, backgrounds and interests in our House is important. Indeed, I see our membership as consisting of three distinct streams. Those who know how we got there, those who have a feel for where we are now, and those who have a sense of how the future might play out. When all three streams are flowing, then the expertise and insight of all our members combines to make us the best think tank in the country. With apologies, Anna. A recent study by the UCL Constitution Unit found that over half of all changes to bills originate in the Lords. One such example happened just a couple of weeks ago when the government announced plans to introduce legislation to stop foreign state ownership of British newspapers. And where did they get this idea? From an amendment proposed by the chair of our Communications and Digital Committee and former BBC executive Baroness Tina Stowell during our consideration of the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Bill. The Spectator's editor Fraser Nelson said last week on this, "Principle was put in front of money by backbenchers in the House of Lords who said that if there wasn't a law stopping newspapers been bought by foreign powers, there should be. So they proposed one. And this is the whole idea of a second chamber, filled with people who do not see politics as a stepping stone. They are free to speak on principle, free to introduce laws when needed, whether the government likes it or not. And as Fraser says, this is an example where the composition of our chamber is an asset, demonstrating the influence and expertise in the House. Other commentators from across the political spectrum agree. Ian Dunn, in his book, How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't, says, and I quote, "The Lords is everything, the Commons is not. It has no majority, so the government does not control it. It values expertise and careful deliberation over partisanship. And perhaps, most importantly of all, it controls its own timetable. It is, of course, through the Commons and through general elections that the government is ultimately accountable to the electorate for its performance. Because our House is appointed, our detailed scrutiny of legislation doesn't encroach on that core accountability of the Commons. There is therefore a key constitutional value to having an appointed House within a bicameral system. As Lord Speaker, I am impartial, and it's for the government to consider in more detail any proposals for change. But any plan for a wholly or partly elected House could have unintended consequences for our constitutional balance. And of course, the more radical the change, then the harder it is to discern what the full impact of reform would be. History informs us that recent attempts to pursue wholesale reform have failed. Such plans fail to resolve the fundamental constitutional tension that would exist between an elected Commons and a wholly or partly elected upper house. However, incremental changes to composition, often developed or implemented with cross-party support, have tended to enjoy more success. Given this history, what are the steps that a government and Parliament could take to reform the House? On appointments, it has been suggested that the House of Lords Appointments Commission, known as HOLAC, could have more powers to challenge nominations. But HOLAC has been constrained in its ability to appoint expert crossbenchers. For example, when it was established from 2001 to 2012, HOLAC nominated 59 independent members. Then, in 2012, the Prime Minister of the day issued a directive to HOLAC limiting these appointments, with the result that only 15 of these peers have been appointed in the following 10 years. Diversity of membership also has to be an important consideration in developing plans for change. Again, if we were releasing the constraints in HOLAC, then we could perhaps give the Commission a renewed focus on seeking to ensure that new appointments reflected the diversity of our population, extending across all nations and regions of the UK. A good start may be to list the hometown of nominated peers when publishing political lists of new members, as is done for New Year's honours. This could begin to challenge any notion that the House is dominated by the interests of London and the South East. There remains an issue regarding the size of the House, which is significantly bigger than the Commons. Since 2016, 45 new peers have been nominated in resignation honours lists. A former leader of the House has proposed that the practice of creating peerages in resignation honours lists should cease. The reason being that prime ministers can no longer be held accountable for their nominations after they have resigned. As with any change, it is ultimately for the Prime Minister, the Government and Parliament to decide the way forward. My hope is that any Prime Minister considering reform will first seek to understand the strengths of our membership, seek to understand the value of our detailed scrutiny of legislation, and seek to understand the strengths of cross-party working and the value of consensus. Now, Hannah, I want to end this note. Modern politics often becomes too heated, thereby clouding judgments and driving polarisation. But I'm reminded of a recent conversation I had with Peter Hennessy, Lord Hennessy of Nimsfield, who told me that the role of the House of Lords is to provide the light rather than the heat. And looking ahead as we face complex domestic and international challenges, it is vital that we seek to keep that light shining brightly. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Lord McFaul. Lots of really interesting remarks there and lots to get our teeth into. And I've already got lots of questions coming in online for you, so there's going to be competition for those in the room. But I'm going to use my chair's privilege to ask you a few questions myself to start with. So you said lots of interesting things there about the focus that you've put on outreach and on helping and ensuring that the House can explain itself and can help try to increase understanding of the House and what you see as its value. But do you think the Lords does enough listening?
Sorry?
Does the Lords do enough listening? Has?
That was a deliberate mistake.
Yes, I know. Just in case anyone hadn't heard. I wonder whether debates, particularly over Lords reform, over R&R, focus too much on what members of the House and both Houses want and what they think the value of the institution is. Do you feel you have enough mechanisms in place to understand what the public wants?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think we can always improve on that, Hannah. But I draw on my experience as chairman of the Treasury Committee for 10 years. And as you know, the financial services industry was in a bit of difficulty at that time, and we needed reform of it. So I established a committee looking into financial services, and I asked David Davis, MP, to chair it. Vince Cable came on it, and when he was Secretary of State, at that election, it was just before the election, he still signed it. So there were three of us parliamentarians signed that. Roger Bootle was on it, Philip Auger was on it, and believe it or not, we had a Benedictine monk on it, because he was our ethics advisor. And I have to say to you, he was the biggest pest of all, but there you are. However, there was an ethical element to it. We produced our report on the May, just before the June 2010 election. And David went to David Cameron and said, can you take this up? David Cameron agreed to take it up. As a result of that, the Vickers Commission was established. Martin Wolfe from the Financial Times and others were on it. And they felt their job was incomplete and had to engage parliamentary engagement. So they set up the Parliamentary Commission for Banking Standards. And three members of the House of Lords, or four, were on it. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who was involved in finance, Nigel Lawson, the late Nigel Lawson, Andrew Turnbull, and myself. And there were members from the House of Commons. The committee was chaired by Andrew Tyrie, my successor. We produced our report, and the government set up some measures to adopt them. Quite a number of them were adopted, but there were other aspects that weren't adopted. And Andrew Tyrie wrote to me eventually and said, it's over to you. And I think Andrew was against the House of Lords at the time. However, we, without a guillotine in the floor of the House of Lords, managed to get these amendments on it. But one key aspect of that report, the Future of Banking Commission, was the Citizens' Assembly engagement that we had. And that was well informed. And I think that that civic initiative and the engagement of the public was really important. And I think that listening to voices, hearing the encountering people with their problems was really, really important. So I'm a fan of citizens' assemblies.
Great. As I mentioned at the start, and I'm sure you didn't think you were going to get away without having to talk about Rwanda this evening, it's something that is focusing lots of minds on the House of Lords at the moment. And as you will be very aware, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, as he sort of saw the bill off from the Commons up to the House of Lords, made this statement urging the Lords not to frustrate the will of the people, as he put it. What did you make of that sort of language?
Well, actually, the Rwanda bill was treated in the same way as every other bill. It comes before us. We do the second reading. The amendments were sent to the House of Commons. I think there were 10 amendments. The government came back, rejecting them all, went back to the House of Lords, and we sent 7 amendments back as a result of that. That's no different from the way we treat everything else. And I think I can quote, as a good spectator, Michael Forsyth. And he said at oral questions last week, he said, "The minister has seen reports this morning in the newspapers suggesting that this House has delayed the passage of the Rwanda bill unnecessarily, resulting in people being exposed to the dangers of the channel. Will he take this opportunity to point out that this House was well prepared to pass the legislation back to the House of Commons for consideration before Easter? That is no fault of the House, that the legislation has been delayed, and that this House has just been doing its job, asking the Commons to think again, and it is not responsible for delaying the legislation." So over to the government business managers.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that the Lords has acted appropriately and gone through what you would expect in terms of legislative scrutiny. But do you think it's a troubling precedent for a Prime Minister to sort of try to put that pressure on the Lords before they start their scrutiny?
Well, I think you see this periodically. I think you saw it with the Labour government, Tony Blair's government. I remember David Blunkett saying to us that the education bill went to the House of Lords and he was hugely frustrated with it. But when it came back, he was delighted with the amendments that were made as a result of that. And then we had earlier, a few years ago, the SI bills. And I think there was a committee set up under Tom Strathclyde, but I don't think it went any further as a result. So we assist the House of Commons by adding value, and that's what we're about. We're not elected. They take the decision at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I think that, but we have seen a sort of, what you might characterise as a more assertive House of Lords in recent years, the government being defeated over 100 times each session in the last three parliamentary sessions. And the last time there were figures that high was in the 1970s. Why do you think that is? Is that because the Lords is getting more disagreeable? Or is it because the government is not offering concessions at an earlier stage as it might have done in the past?
I think it could be the state of the legislation when it comes to the House of Lords. In that regard, let me take the Levelling Up Bill. Levelling Up Bill came to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords, on its 10th day of scrutinising it, had more amendments than there was in day one. So, if you like, what would be ascribed as a deficiency of the bills when we come along are addressed in the House of Lords. In the House of Commons, it doesn't have the time for that. There are quite a number of reasons for it. But with the guillotine, there's very limited time. And given the present situation with members of Parliament having to focus on social media and pointing outwards on that, there's less time for that. And they're not particularly interested on it. You know, I said, when I was in 1987, and my colleagues here will note it, We had all-nighters now. I don't advocate that at all. But that was what happened. And Michael Forsyth's quote, I remember Michael taking the education bill through, and I think we had two all-nighters in succession. And I went home on the Thursday, so I'd been up over two nights. And I went into the local news agent shop on the Friday. I was getting papers and rolls. And I get a tap on the shoulder by one of my constituents. He says, well, there you are, McFall, a four-day week. So you can't even win.
I mean, I think that's a really important point about the quality of the legislation which the Lords is being asked to consider, and particularly, as you say, if there were bills which had their scrutiny in theory in the Commons, and then the government introduces a whole swathe of new amendments in the Lords, that's difficult, particularly, again, for the Lords in doing their detailed scrutiny, which you highlight is a particular strength of the upper house, and they know that those haven't even been under consideration in the Commons, yeah. That they're going to want to pay close attention to that. And I also, harking back to my own experience when I was in the Public Bill Office in the Commons in the sort of early 2000s, a sort of bill on immigration would go into committee stage for a number of weeks rather than being considered on the floor of the House in a couple of sessions, as we've seen more recently. So I do think that has changed a lot. Do you think the answer is, again, I'm very much in sympathy with your points about, you know, if there is to be reform of the upper house, it must take account of the really valuable role in legislative scrutiny that the Lords plays. Is that enough, though, or do you think we also need to think about the incentives on MPs to get them to do better scrutiny? Should we just say, well, that's not how it is, they have social media, they have other priorities, it should be for the upper house to do this, or do you think we should also be thinking about how the Commons could up their game?
I think that's for the Commons to do, but I think the present environment would make it very hard for them to get back to that, and they've got into the routine in that area. Perhaps there could be more understanding with the Lords and the committees, and the engagement of the Lords could be used in a way where the House of Commons takes note of that, whether we go back to, say, takes it back to a joint committee in looking at that. I mentioned the Parliamentary Commission for Banking Standards. We came out with a unanimous report on the most sensitive subject in financial regulation, and Nigel Lawson was right at the heart of that in 1987. So that could be done. And when I chaired the Treasury Committee, I was very clear with individuals that we needed unanimous reports all the time. Otherwise, our reports would be devalued. It would be seen as a Conservative report, it would be seen as a Labour report. So engaging the House of Commons on these issues is really important. And I don't want to be hugely critical, because I was in the House of Commons for 23 years, but quite a number of MPs don't know the real work of the House of Commons. And that need for engagement is important. And public bodies don't know a need. My colleague, Lord Rooker, chaired the Food Standards Body, and Jeff said that there was not much understanding in the civil service and in his department about it. So that closer engagement is necessary, and I think the House of Lords would rise to that challenge.
Do you think there's more that could be done to drive up the standard of legislation before it gets introduced to Parliament? There's been ideas such as the Hansard Society's suggestion of a sort of legislative standards committee. Do you think that would help so that, you know, it's not left to the Lords to try to do all the work they have to do? Do you think there should be something which is a sort of vetting body to try to make sure that legislation meets basic standards before it's introduced?
Yeah, I think we need that preparatory work in many ways before it comes to the floor of the House, so that it could be tidied up and we give it a good scrub in the face as a result of that. But there's a number of initiatives that took place. We've got our joint committees at the moment, and I'm only quoting this, but what some of my members say is that when we have these joint committees, it's usually members of the House of Lords that are the last out the door.
So you highlighted towards the end of your speech what you think of as the sort of really important roles of the House of Lords, its expertise, its legislative scrutiny, its cross-party working. Given those things, what do you think is the optimum size of the House of Lords?
Well, we had the Lord Speaker's Committee, which Lord Fowler set up, and I think the notional figure at that time was 600. I think the House of Lords numbers should be less than the House of Commons, and we need to engage to get that. Lord Fowler's committee, chaired by Terry Burns, advocated two in one, you know, two out, one in. And I think...
seems to have slipped somewhat.
The most faithful Prime Minister, that was Theresa May, and that worked very well, but things went a bit screwy. You know, that's all I'll say.
Just a couple more for me, and then I will be coming to the floor, so do have your questions ready. One of the things we do at the IFG is try to work with ministers to help them understand their roles, to be to have the skills to do their roles well. We think it's a really difficult job, and we think that they don't get enough support. We think that, you know, at any point, being a minister is a really difficult job. Being appointed to Parliament in order to become a minister, as Lords Ministers are, is a doubly difficult job because you have to learn the whole of how Parliament works as well as how to become a minister, which is in itself hard. Do you think that Lords Ministers get enough support in their roles?
Well, I worked with Alf Dubs in Northern Ireland, and Alf had much more responsibility than ourselves, having that dual role in that. And there is I need to recognise the job that they do and have at least an equal basis with ministers in the House of Commons.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I was really struck by was listening to Lord Bethell talk about his workload during the COVID pandemic and the number of SIs and so on he had to handle. And, of course, Lords Ministers have to do the whole sweep of a departmental brief. So, yeah, we think they have it particularly tough. You mentioned the external management review, which the Lords has undergone, and that was obviously partly a response to quite difficult stories about Parliament as a workplace, which emerged after Me Too.
With Dale and Bogan report before that.
Exactly. Are you confident that no such stories could be told about the House of Lords by people working in the House of Lords today?
Well, Dale and Bogan, I think, mentioned that there was a divide within the administration of the fast-track individuals and the policy analysts who came along on that. And there's work to do in that area as well. But the essence of the external management view, it was organisational management, but the culture of the place. And it had been mentioned to me by the author that the House of Lords was maybe 10 years behind the rest of the civil service. And I think maybe historically, and I'm only having a guess here, but historically it was seen as the administration and the members, and there was a gap between them. And when I did the review of committees, I had the chairs of the committees come before us. I think Michael Forsyth, Lord Patel, Anne Taylor and others, quite formidable members. And what they said to us was, look, we need to examine difficult issues. But by examining difficult issues, that doesn't mean that there's going to be any conflict as a result. And I think that initial cultural approach was administration. Don't get too near the politicians because we don't want to get in any trouble with it. But we had to embrace that aspect. And I think it has been much improved, and at the time we gave an extra budget to the communications department, and they've been doing a good job in that. But on the committees, I don't. It was David Natsler, former chair, clerk of the House of Commons, who said, "What's the use of having fine reports and put them on the floor of the House and talking to yourselves about the positives? And you need to do more." And I think the Environment Committee has engaged young people after they've produced the report, and they're listening to their concerns on that. So I think it needs, that committee report needs to go out and engage the wider public, because whilst MPs have their constituents, our constituents, if you like, are the general public, and engaging the general public, and there's quite a bit to do in that yet.
Final question for me is, we're going to have an election this year. We're going to have either the same or a new Prime Minister after the next election. What would you like them to have at the forefront of their mind when they're thinking about the House of Lords?
Order. Well, understand the House of Lords. That's the first thing. Because if they rush in to issues, there can be unintended consequences. I remember Alistair Darling said to me, the late Alistair, at the time when the Lord Chancellor's post was abolished, he was the Secretary of State for Scotland, and he said that what happened after that was that workmen came up to Dover House and took off the nameplate Scotland office. At lunchtime, he went down, spoke to relevant people, and then in the afternoon, the same workmen came up and put it back up again. So unintended consequences, watch them.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we're going to go to questions from the floor. We'll have my colleague Lauren has a microphone, so please wait for her to get to you before you ask your question. As I say, it's always useful to know who you are if you would like to ask a question. And as I say, I will come to these excellent questions which are coming in online. So Lauren, could we start the person here? We'll take
groups
of two or three, if
that's
okay.
What? Okay? Yeah.
I'm Peter Kellner, I suppose, interested to declare my wife is a member of the...
I know that. Peter Kellner, we know that.
Ultimately, the Parliament Act is available to the Lords to delay by a year a Commons legislation, and it's very, very seldom used for the obvious reason that it looks bad for the unelected House to overrule the elected House. So two questions. Is the Parliament Act worth keeping? And secondly, if it is, in what circumstances in principle do you think it could be appropriate these days for the House of Lords to use it and to impose that delay?
Very good question.
Well,
should we take it?
Oh, sorry,
Or do you want to do them one at a time?
On you go, no.
Yeah. Behind you, sorry.
Sorry, I'm Timothy Lord Kirkhope, and I just want to say, Lord Speaker, how much our colleagues here tonight appreciate what you've just said, but also want to support you very strongly in the way that you're conducting proceedings. But can I just ask this question? That many of us are part of the Learn with the Lords process, which is really quite exciting, dealing with a lot of schools. Little primary boy, 8 years old, came to the microphone the other day when I did one online and said, I'm starting my speech, the grandiose speech, and he said, before you start, he said, this is an eight-year-old with no script, before you start, I want you to know that I am the Prime Minister of my school and my job is to welcome you here. And it conducted, this was a primary school in Bolton in Lancashire. And I just want to say to you that I think getting hold of young people and advising them on what the House of Lords does and getting them interested in the whole political process is really valuable. I want to ask you, just if you have a moment when you answer, to say whether you think there's anything further that we could be doing with your background in education as well to try and illuminate young people more in what we are doing and the whole process of politics.
Thank you. There's a lady.
Thank you. Thank you, Lord Speaker. This is Rasika. I'm a civil servant in DLAC, and a lot of my role involves significant engagement with Parliament, both the Commons and the Lords. And before I go to my question, I must place this on record. It's my gratitude, because I've engaged with a lot of Lords ministers, and in my eyes, House of Lords is the House of Experts. And I've been thoroughly enriched by whatever briefings or contributions I've done to the Lords till date. But coming to the question, I think Hannah touched on it a little bit, but going a tad bit further, we did speak about legislative scrutiny, And I recognise there's a secondary legislation scrutiny committee at the Lords. Do you reckon we need one for primary legislation as well? And if there's one, how would that look like, broadly in your view? Thank you.
Good. Peter, I think the Parliament Act has been used four times since 1949. Is it worth keeping? Some of my colleagues say, yes, it's worth keeping. It can be delayed a year, but what about 6 months delay on that? Given the House of Lords is unelected and the House of Commons is elected, I think that what I get across is that we don't legislate the House of Lords. We assist the House of Commons in the work that we're doing. And generally speaking, I wouldn't advocate the House of Lords in an unelected position, thinking that it had the same influence as power as the House of Commons. At the end of the day, they have to do that. Whether it's removed or not is a moot point, but the suggestion by one of my colleagues who's here tonight that it had been delayed 6 months, maybe there's one that could be in the pot as a result of it. But remember, it's only held up legislation four times since 1949. Tim, the education and young people, it is hugely important. Like yourself, I was an MP and I went around every school every year and spoke to people. And by the way, I had the same experience as you, because I went to a small village in a place called Renton. By the way, Renton, a small village, they won the Scottish Cup in 1871, and they still talk about it and that. But the teacher asked who I was, and some young fella put his hand up. He's John McFall. Who's John McFall? Prime Minister of Renton. So it's similar with them on that. But getting to young people is important. And I addressed a teachers' forum in Parliament maybe a month or so back, and there were 70 or 80 teachers there. And the aim of that was to ensure that the teachers went back and spoke to their pupils about the House of Lords. And we had quite a bit of feedback. My staff showed me it. And one of them was, well, I didn't agree with the House of Lords, the teacher said. But I've listened to the speeches this week, and I'm going to go back and change the curriculum as a result of that experience. So it is really important. And I mentioned Lord Rees of Ludlow this morning. It's a fascinating interview. I've got a science background, but I thought it was absolutely fantastic. He was saying, and he was asking about people who've got the charisma and the appeal to change thinking on a global scale. One was Pope Francis, with his encyclical Laudato Si on the link between humans and creation. Two was who came to the house? I've just forgotten the name.
Stuart Russell?
No, sorry. Right, it'll come back to me. That's a senior moment. But the third one, he says, was Greta Thunberg, a young people. And we've got to remember that we've got to reach out to these young people, because what world have we left them? And what's the future going to be for them? And they need to be educated on these big issues, whether it's in the primary school or whether it's in the secondary school. And I agree entirely, as a former teacher, I think young people, it's important for us to get to. And I mentioned learning with the Lords, and we've got people with different experience in the Lords going to schools. And I think that's good, getting that range over to them.
And I think we had a question about whether we need a primary legislative scrutiny committee to augment the secondary legislation scrutiny committee.
Well, the secondary legislation scrutiny committee was very critical of the government with SIs and the Henry VIII clauses on that. And it's Lord Bencathra was one who came to me on that. And there's a big job for us to do there. But hopefully we're knocking at a door which could open at the end of the day. But when David Cameron and George Osborne sent SIs to the Commons, I think it was with Welfare Bill, I think they thought that this was a way to ensure that the Act passed in the House of Commons. But what they didn't realise is when it gets sent to the House of Lords, it's in the ownership of the House of Lords. And that was something that they missed. And Baroness Holland, she worked at that very, very hard. But the government at the time didn't like it. And as a result of that, Tom Strathclyde's committee was set up. But I think that David Blunkett, Helen Liddell, for example, a friend of mine, she was in charge of the energy bills, Chief Secretary of Treasury. And she says, when the bill came back for the House of Lords, my eyes lit up because it was so complex on it. And maybe if we teach prime ministers and chancellors in the future the help to understand the House of Lords, I'm quite happy to give them a tutorial.
Very good.
Pardon? Spend time in the Lords before they're elected.
Exactly.
I'm going to take a couple of the most popular questions online. Chris B says, despite the initial fury, isn't it actually the case that the Foreign Secretary receives an even higher standard of scrutiny in the House of Lords, containing, as it does, expert retired ambassadors, admirals, civil servants, NATO Secretary General, which I think is a point that you were pointing towards.
Yeah, I think the scrutiny is, well, I can't say, it would be wrong for me as non-political to say it's better than the House of Commons, but there's a depth to the House of Lords that's not there. I remember in Brexit we were discussing Article 50, and there were some members waxing eloquently about it. And then Lord Kerr of Kinlochard stood up, EU ambassador, endless missions on behalf of the government, and he says, I'll tell you about Article 50, because I wrote it. And he says, and by the way, he says, I wrote it with this pen. So having that depth of scrutiny is really important. And David Cameron was in to see me just after he was appointed. And whilst he didn't say it out loud, I felt that he was subject to real challenging questions. He felt that.
The second most popular question online is an anonymous one. What are you doing to tackle direct conflicts of interest with the House of Lords select committees, for instance? And I guess this is a virtue of their expertise and so on. Members of the new Financial Services Regulation Committee include chairs and NEDs of regulated banks and firms.
Well, that's not my remit, and I'm non-political on that. But when members go on the committee, they have to declare with the clerks any conflicts of interest they have, and also they have to declare in the reports where they come from. So I think that's a bit hypothetical, that question at the moment. If we get any substance on it, see us on it. And by the way, the second person I mentioned after Pope Francis was David Attenborough, so it's come to me.
Very good. I'll take one more round from the room. I know I've got a question here. Lauren, the secondary.
William Wallace, House of Lords. My question is almost to the Institute of Government. I mean, what would we like most with the new government? The Institute for Government to train new ministers in what the legislative process really needs to be, because part of what seems to me as a participant to have broken down in recent years is the idea that the legislative process should be a dialogue between the two houses in which ministers respond to Lords' criticism by coming up with government amendments which match some of the criticisms. That's almost stopped in the last 2 years, and that's part of why Lords' votes against the government are much stronger. So a better understanding of how the two houses can complement each other and the Lords make up for the Commons' abandonment of scrutiny of legislation would be a great help to all of us.
We'll take a couple more questions. Gentleman behind.
Matthew Ives, Parliamentary Assistant to the Chair of PACAC. As you'll be aware, PACAC currently have a House of Lords reform inquiry. We had Baroness Deitch and Lord Bew in this morning, in fact, as Hannah will know. And what was discussed was on the topic of size and a lot of work that you've done with changing and modernising the optics for House of Lords reform on HOLAC itself. I just wanted to ask you directly, Lord McFall, and I understand your constitutional position on this, but is HOLAC fit for purpose? And could there be any modernisation or changes to it? And if so, how?
Good. And one more in front.
Elliot Wilson, I was a clerk in the House of Commons and briefly in the House of Lords. You talked about size. Given that, as you will know, the size of the House of Lords actively is still small in the Commons, is size a reputational problem or a logistical problem?
Good. Okay. Is that it?
That's it.
Can I start with the last one? I think the average attendance per day in the House of Lords is about 420 to 450. So those are working peers. Size does matter in that there's that perception of the House of Lords being bloated, it's bigger than the Chinese Communist Party Forum, whatever else. And as an MP for years, perception is reality. And I think we do have to respond to that. In HOLAC, I know the members of HOLAC have been a bit frustrated on occasion. And I was speaking to the Canadian speaker who came to visit me a few weeks ago, and they said that in their parliament they have an independent committee like HOLAC, but the Prime Minister doesn't appoint them on his own. They look at them, they vet them. In fact, they don't just vet them for propriety. They vet them for what their experience is and what they're going to do in the House of Lords. And that suggestion, I think, is worthy of further examination in that. And members of HOLAC that I've been speaking to, in fact, Baroness Deitch was in to see me yesterday, so I'm not relaying here anything that Baroness Deitch said, which is very important. But there's a lot of people who have applied independently to HOLAC, and I think that there is a great need to ensure that we do have that expertise from the independent crossbenchers. And one of the features, as you know, of the House of Lords is that no legislator, no votes can get through from the government otherwise if crossbenchers don't engage in that. And I think that expertise would help, extra expertise would help mark the division between the House of Commons and the House of Lords in their powers and in their composition. So I think that would be of assistance to it. And Lord Wallace, the bill's been simpler. That's the essence of your question. Absolutely, be simple. I remember when I was in the chair in the Treasury Committee, and we had such complex briefs from the financial services industry. And my instruction was, I don't understand half of it. So make it the words half, and then we'll start to realise it. Quantitative easing. Why don't we have a simpler word for that as a result? And again, in the Treasury Committee, I engaged with the wider public, and they had a say on that, and threefold aims with the Treasury Committee. One, that I engage my members of the committee and give them their day in the sun, because you show them respect in that. Two, that we educate the members on the floor of the House, because I see the role of the Commons changing, and the real work has been transferred from the floor of the House to committees on that. So that educating the floor of the House is really important. And the third one was to build a bridge between the committee and the public as a result of that. And I remember hearing the chair of the Financial Conduct Authority, the Governor of the Bank of England, and the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, coming along all at the one time. And we put out an invitation to people to engage with us. And at that time, over 600 did it. I would say that getting the Chancellor, the Governor, and the Chair of the Financial Conduct Authority wasn't easy as a result of that, because they'd usually come on their own. But being able to have that interchange element was very important. So that transparency is important, and the accountability.
I think the question was also partly to me. So I completely agree that with exactly the point that Lord McFall's been making about the balance in terms of scrutiny between the Commons and the Lords, and I totally agree with you, Lord Wallace, about the sort of change in the way in which the government seems to be approaching that dialogue, which we used to think of as the sort of the what legislative scrutiny was about. One house takes its view, the next house takes its view, and then there's a resolution. I think that we have seen a lot of dubious precedents set over the last decade or so in terms of the legislative scrutiny process, and I think that a lot of members of both houses have little experience of anything other than the last decade, because they will have joined, over a third of the House of Commons joined after 2016, so has only really experienced the legislative process during Brexit and during COVID, when lots of things have had to be done fast or with limited physical presence in the chamber and all these sorts of things. So I think we need a bit of a reset. I think that it would be really valuable, the sort of the way I'm trying to think about it is that in 2010, the House of Commons really thought about select committee scrutiny and how it could be enhanced. And that was when, well, it was the right committee before that, but the changes were introduced with elections and so on to select committees in 2010. And now people say that the select committee system is one of the strongest aspects of our parliament. I think we need a similar hard look at our legislative scrutiny processes. I think we need a 2010 moment for legislative scrutiny, because very few people think that that it's a robust system which is delivering reliable results. And as Lord McFall's made the very good point, that there's lots of discussion of reform of the House of Lords, and if there were unforeseen consequences which affected the ability of the Lords to do the lion's share of the legislative scrutiny as it does now, then I think that would be really problematic. So the IFG is thinking about these issues, and we are hoping to do some work. We always offer sort of support and try to get our research and thinking across to ministers. We will do the same thing after the next election as we are doing now, talking to ministers in the run-up to the next election and making these points, and we will continue to do so. Thanks.
And Lord Norton, as Lord Wallace knows, has done quite a lot of work on that, very good stuff. And I think we sort of need to formalise it a bit and engage government, whoever's in government, on it, rather than an ad hoc arrangement, because it doesn't listen. In that way. So advocating the formality of it, I think, would be important, and bringing the House of Commons in on that. But it's not just individual MPs. Lord Norton, Lord Young, and others, myself involved, set up an informal group, invited MPs to come along and engage with us so that they could better understand. But the number coming, there were about half a dozen came at the beginning, but it was very hard to attract them, as you know, if you're getting MPs and very important speakers coming along. Yeah. So I think there's a formal element to that.
But also, you also mentioned the SLSC and the Delegated Powers Committee and the Lords have always also done a lot of work in this. So I think that's something that we would definitely advocate building on. Well, I think we're going to have to let you all go, because we only said this was going to last an hour, although we could clearly go on for much longer. Can I ask you to join me in thanking Lord McFall for a really interesting speech?